Rather prosaic, right? You know, in the underground, and show what damn fools the FBI was all during that time. When we came back after we'd been gone for 4 years, and Siggy was down to Madison, he was talking with reporters on the Capital Times, and they said to him, they were very concerned, especially John Hunter, you know. He said, "Do you mean to say that these people were here for 4 years and came to meetings and everything, the FBI couldn't find them? What's the matter with the FBI anyway?" That's a good question.
Yeah, but that'd be a
better. What can they find without stool pigeons, you know? They can't find anything, in spite of all their technical apparatus.
So how could they find their meeting Sunday without following people out there and stuff like that? With all their tapping of wires and...
Sure.
And wiring places and so forth.
Well, now maybe we better start out. So in 1929, We had the party just come through the factional fight. And we had a very small party here, as I told you, up north, see? And the first thing, Ray Hansborough joined in August 1929, and in November I joined the party. And I was working in the Westinghouse Electric Company at that time. We decided that we would try to organize a union in there, the Steel and Metal Workers Industrial Union of the Trade Union Unity League, see? So they asked me to write a leaflet, and what did I do? I come back with 14 pages, single-spaced, typewritten, supposed to be a leaflet. It had listed all the grievances and the wages and the hours and everything in the plant. Well, the comrades said they wouldn't make a leaflet, so they went ahead and they made a leaflet. And bingo, the whole party leadership landed in jail because there's nobody to distribute but the party leadership, you see. And, well, after a little while, they had another leaflet distribution and they all went to jail again, see. We hadn't won the right of leaflet distribution. We had a fight over everything in this town then. It was a broad open shop. There wasn't hardly a union here except the railroad unions, and they were very exclusive. In fact, that summer when I was on the railroad here in the freight depot and I asked to join the union, they said, "You'd be a damn fool to waste your money joining the union." You know, they told me not to join it. And I tried to get in, I couldn't get in. The railway clerks. Nobody hardly belonged to unions. A few building trades workers, that was about all. Hmm. And we started the attempts to organize the unions here. And anyway, the result of this organizing drive was that there was a very nice looking girl there. There were about 600 people working in Westinghouse Electric to make light bulbs. And most of them were women. And I had a job. I had to break up cartons and flatten them out. Being a big trust like that, they don't waste anything. They use the cartons over and over and over again. They ship them back to their plants in New Jersey and then tape them up again, you know, and use them over and over until they wear out, you see. My job was just to gather up the cartons and from all the machines and bring them up there. And the women really had to work like hell there. I've seen the women sit on these, they had a bank of machines to make the bulbs. One of them would blow the glass, you know, the glass was already blown. I mean, they came as blanks some of them would assemble the wires, you know, in the glass tube that went inside the bulb. Others had on the sealers. And they just sat there on a stool and they just moved their arms up and down like that all day long. And sometimes they couldn't go to the can without having somebody take their place. And sometimes they just fall in a faint off from the stool right on the floor. You know.
In a 10-hour day?
See? Had an 8-hour day then in that place. That was one of the first times they ever worked an 8-hour day. So I got all around among all the women in the whole damn place there, and I kept preaching union. And here was this prim and prissy little gal, you know, and she says, "I wonder how I could get to the union meeting." Now, somebody told me that she was sleeping with the boss and should watch out for her, but I was always honest, you know. And I says, "I don't know. I don't belong to the union, but I do know somebody who does." And that night I got my dismissal. See, that was January 1st, 1929. I never had another job in a factory after that until we went underground in 1950. There were 21 years. I was working WPA and a few things like that in between. So So here we were, and the depression had started, only nobody knew it except the party. Well, I was looking for work, and the people used to wander by the thousands around Milwaukee. We used to start out at Ellis Chalmers. That was the first place in the morning. And then we'd go to all the shops. There was Prestolite shop out there. They remember the old Prestolite thing where you had these tanks that stuck on the running board and had these lights on the cars? That became the Presteel Tank Company later on, I think. And then Blackhawk Ranch, and we go to Harnish Beggars, and we make the shops on Burnham. We go down to Harvester, and we'd hike up here to A.O. Smith, Smith on 27th Street, and then over to Seaman Body. That was a day's hike. Now that's about a 25-mile hike. And it wasn't one person. It was thousands of men and women, mostly men then, but thousands of them, literally thousands, just in a swarm moving around, you see. And, well, they'd tell you, come back in February, come back in March. And Hoover was saying prosperity was around the corner. And then we'd meet some of these guys, old wobblies and bums and everything, and they'd say, well, for Christ's sake, we got to eat. And so you'd always pal up with two or three guys, you know, get around together. I was just new in the party, but I knew that our job was to try to organize the unemployed, you know. But you'd get palling with a few guys as you walked around, and we began breaking up into little units, and then we'd go down different streets where there were bakeries and bum bakery goods and bum stuff, began to, you know, bum our way around. Then we'd get back together again, and we'd have some sandwiches and be able to keep moving the whole day. Well, I had money saved up, and had insurance policies and everything. I had a few hundred bucks. I planned to go back to school eventually, and I was figured to stay another few years. Well, anyway, we had a meeting of the party leadership here, and they decided that instead of my finding work and going back in the factory, I should be assigned to unemployed work. So we set up a committee. Ray Hansbrough. No!
Oh, honey.
Ray Hansbrough and Leo Fisher and myself and Donald Burke, we were the committee to organize the unemployed. Well, how are you going to organize? The first thing you do is read the pamphlet that was issued by the Strasbourg Conference of the Red International Labor Unions on unemployment, see?
Strasbourg?
Yeah, it's held in Strasbourg, Germany. Germany, not France, you know, it is now. And in there they said that the unemployed should be organized unemployed council. What's an unemployed council? We didn't know. So we're going to organize unemployed councils. So what's the first thing to do? We go down to the slave market, they call it, the old employment office, down on the old Whorehouse Street, Market Street, River Street, which is now called Edison Street. It was on Kilbourne. And across the road from there, there were these electric light poles made out of granite, cemented together, you know. They were laying on skids across the road there in a big lot that went down to the river, you see. And here this slave market was a two or three story building, and most of the unemployed waited in the basement, and their names used to be posted up there, just like they are up in Duluth, you know, on the board, not the names, but the jobs would be posted. And the people waited, and then they were unemployed, and many of them had lost their rooming houses, and that was the only place to go. And it stank, and I'm telling you, the floor was so slimy with cigarette butts and spit and everything that, and so the air was so full of smoke, it was like going into some kind of a slave ship or something to go into that basement. You just had to blink your eyes, you couldn't see. And then all you walk around, all that slush and slime, and the cans are running over, and the smell of urine and filth and everything. And that was where the unemployed congregated, by the hundreds, you see. And they were mostly laborers and workers in the factories and everything. And they were kind of hopeless. Well, so what do? Run into an old wobbly by the name of Scarborough there, a guy with a great big Roman nose and a ponderous form, and a fellow that was known among the, on the skid rows all over the country. And he's spoken on Union Square, you know, and Bughouse Square and Chicago and every place out and down in Frisco. He was a very poetic guy, known Ralph Chaplin and everything else. So we teamed up, we made a united front between us communists and this wobbly gang. There were some of these old, tough harvest hands among the wobblies. You know, the guys You can recognize them at a minute. Their faces are like granite, and their shoulders are broad, you know, and they just soon kill a man as look at them. They probably killed a good many of them in their time. They're really tough guys, you know. Tough eggs and class conscious to the core, you know, and for the revolution to the limit, you see. And so we went down there, and I says to Scarborough and these other guys, we had a committee, but actually it was all pretty much left up to me in the first stage, you see. And the Communist International, the Red International Labor Unions have proclaimed an International Day of Unemployment on February 29th. So I come to the board we had there with the proposal that what we do is hold a series of demonstrations, see. We speak at the slave market where the thousands of people are gathering around there today. We build it up and we hold a series of demonstrations. Then on February 29th, we hold a big ring-a-roo, you see. All the comrades agreed. So what do? We go down to the slave market and we start speaking. Below zero weather, colder than a bitch out there, you know. And the guys freezing in their ragged clothes and everything. And, first thing we do, we ain't got no soapbox, so pick up one of those paving blocks. And I said to Scarborough, I never made a speech before in my life, but I'll try to get them around together. We've about 10 feet back, there's an empty lot there next to the slave market. And I says, I'll try to get them together. And when they get together, you make the speech because you're the speaker. And so I gets up on this block, you know, and I begins to talk, and Christ, they couldn't hear me from here to the pantry. You know, it was colder than the devil. The guys began gathering around, and then who comes over but the mayor's secretary? The city hall is a block away. See, their own secretary, Mike Phillips. Name was Mike Kluszewski, but he changed it to made it Phillips, you see, and his brother later became chief of police. Mike Phillips came over and said, you can't talk here. I said, what do you mean you can't talk here? This is public property. We got free speech here and so on. And we argued. He had a police uniform on. He was a sergeant. So he didn't want, you know, it was a little politically embarrassing if they threw our hangers in. And they've been doing that to everybody in town here for years before that. Sacco Vanzetti demonstrations and everything. They laid down the rule that you couldn't have any meetings in the restricted area in the downtown, running from Milwaukee Street up about 10th Street or 8th Street, something like that. It's just about the area where the city direct current service is, you know, from the city power plant. You weren't supposed to hold no speeches there without a permit. We said, to hell with the speeches and with the permits. We made the streets. We got the right, you know. Well, he didn't want too much argument. He went back. Then he come back and he said, I was still introducing the speaker, I guess, or something, or the speaker was speaking, he come back and interrupted some more. But Scarborough, he already began to show his yellow streak, you know, when the cop comes over. But Philip says, listen, he says, now we got to be reasonable. He says, what do you want to do? You don't want to make trouble for Mayor Holm, for the mayor, and for the city administration. He says, this is city property, you're right. You got a right to speak here. But he says, why don't you go across the street and speak on that empty lot over there? Says, for Christ's sake, look over there, all them telephone poles and everything. But he says, do it there. The people will complain. The state is complaining, you know, that you're obstructing around the employment agency. So, all right, I figured that the best thing to do was to compromise a little bit, you know. Maybe in principle, maybe we shouldn't have compromised, should have fought it out then and there, but we didn't. We went across the street. And the guys began flocking out of that slave market. You had one of the most an institution grew up in this town in the next couple of months. It was the most remarkable things you ever saw in your life. Every day, twice a day, we held our services out there, starting in the morning and in the afternoon, in that cold weather and rain and snow and everything. And hundreds and even thousands of people would gather around and listen. Well, first Scarborough, he had the day, you see. He had a big voice and he'd get up and talk in a very colorful lingo. I met a fellow, a college professor years later, who used to listen. And he said, you fellows, he says, you really did remarkable things with the King's English down there. This Scarborough would get up and he'd refer to Chicago Tribune as the Chicago Tri-Bunk and the Milwaukee Urinal, you know. And he'd talk about the dukes and the cukes and the counts and the no counts and so on, you know. But the only trouble with him is he had only one speech. He kept repeating it over and over again. I got up there and I spoke in a very dry voice, you know, and I didn't know, I never spoken. After a while, he got more volume, and he used to undercut me all the time. He'd go to the covers and he'd say, "What do you have that jackass up there for? Nobody can hear him. He's got no oratorical style or anything." And so we went on. We had this united front. There were others speak. We'd call anybody up to speak. Once in a while, some guy would come up there, and we'd sell the Daily Worker there. He'd say, "Use it for toilet paper or something like that," and somebody would take a poke at him. We'd have a few little incidents like that. But what began to happen after the early part of February, after it had been going about a month, crowds got bigger, the demand for action, something's got to be done. So we called a demonstration in front of the city hall, and we had maybe 500,000-600,000 people down there. And we were in front of the city hall, and we were speaking, and we marched from the Haymarket, from the slave market, we marched around, you know, and we went down the city hall. I forget the exact route that we took. The cops wanted us to give a route, and we told them, "Go to hell." And they asked, "Who's your leaders?" And we'd say, "We don't know. We got a committee." "And who's the committee?" "We don't know, you know." Nobody was the leader, you see. We got down in front of the city hall, and there they had a statue to the founder of the Humane Society, I think it was, with a fountain, and around it was a trough for the horses to drink in, you see. And we stood up on that damn trough there, and we began speaking. It was right out in where Wells Street comes down. There were streetcar lines coming the other way, on both sides of the city hall, I believe they went then. It was a very busy place, and we were kind of disrupting the traffic a little bit. So the cops started running into us with motorcycles, and here's where these old wobblies, where you could see them at work. It was really, really an interesting thing. They tipped them damn motorcycles over, and they took them cops and threw them in a drinking fountain. And you never saw nothing like it. And a few of us got pinched, you see. They broke us up, and then we went under the city hall. There's great big porches there, and they raised some of us up on the shoulders, and we spoke to them on the shoulders of the crowd. We had one guy who was in the British general strike, and he said, when the cops attack you, he says, "Come with their club." He said, "Always fall on your back, because then they can't hit you so easy. They only hit you on the arms and legs. They can't hit you on the head." And the old tactics come up from all different ways, from the Seattle general strike and from the out in Colorado, from every place. These guys told of all the different tactics of fighting the cops and how to act in a demonstration. And we had our headquarters up on 6th and Juno, across from the Brisbane Hall, where the Socialist Party was, right across the street from them, where the Milwaukee Leader was published. And every day, besides the outdoor meetings, we had meetings upstairs where we tried to organize. We'd invite them up to our headquarters. 100, 200 people would come up there, and we'd try to rustle up some grub for them. Some of them we let sleep up there. The whole damn place got infested with bed bugs after a while, and every kind of fleas and lice and every damn thing. But we held these meetings, and there we'd sign people up. Now, we had no conception what an unemployed council was, so we just issued slips of paper and told them write down their name and their address and what union they belonged to, what shop they worked at. And we got thousands of names. So we thought we had an organization. We just had thousands of names, and including a number of police officers that were sent into the thing. So we held this first demonstration. Then we held another one, a second demonstration. And that one we held down in front of the Milwaukee Road Depot. And our chief speaker was a young girl, 13 years old, a Finnish-American girl. We called her Betty Hayes. And she had a fur coat. And they made a big to-do about the unemployed and the woman with a fur coat who was speaking. Only 13 years old, but she made a rousing speech there. And the third one came on February 29th. But meanwhile, the international movement decided they hadn't had enough time for the international demonstration. They postponed it a week to March the 6th. But our February 29th one was a big one, too. It kept growing and growing. In between, there were countless incidents. We went down to the rescue mission with a whole bunch of people. We had our soup, and then we listened to the prayer, and then we stood up and denounced the whole business, you know, and everybody walked out of the rescue mission. They opened up somebody tried to start a racket, the Republican Club or something, and they opened up a free food depot on 5th and McKinley, And we let a whole gang down. We announced it. We let about 400 guys down. We raided the free food depot. The guys did. They went in there and they come out of the windows carrying wieners and hams and every damn thing. And it kept, you know, it kept getting more obstreperous. And there were a million little incidents happening all over town. The unemployed were getting stirred up. Then March 6th come around. Meanwhile, the police held a conference, the mayor and everybody, they decided that revolution was on the march in Milwaukee.
Is this the socialist mayor they had then?
Yeah, Mayor Holm. And the chief of police was a socialist, Laubenheimer was his name. And they, in fact, I think they had pretty near a majority in the county board and in the city council, pretty darn close, you know. But they decided revolution was on the march and they had to chop its head off, you see. And they prepared for that March 6th. We never knew it until afterward, but it became obvious. Our March 6th demonstration we held on the Haymarket here on 5th and Bleak. And of course we were steeped already in the traditions of the Chicago Haymarket, and that's why we picked that same name, you know. 1886, we had many veterans of 1886 in Milwaukee, you know, 9 guys were killed. We had already attached to this unemployed movement, ex-socialists and wobblies and everything. And the February 29th demonstration, I think it was one of these early ones, Scarborough got arrested. And he proceeded to tell how Moscow was sending millions of dollars in gold over here and how the local leaders of the unemployed movement were paid by Moscow.
Oh.
He became a stool pigeon, you see. Didn't even make a ripple in the movement. And, you see, he got drunk. That's what happened to him. And they put the heat on. And so Scarborough welched on us, and we lost him. And some of the others did the same thing. And the YCL was, meanwhile, was going parallel, organizing their own movement among the youth. And a Hearst reporter busted up one of their demonstrations by scattering pennies among the kids and taking their pictures, you know, and ridiculing them and so on. But the two things were going, I mean, the youth movement and the other movement was going along. And here it comes out of 20 or 30 people in town that are in the party, you know, and only a few of them are active. And in the course of this, Ray Hansbrough come to the fore as a very eloquent speaker. He'd been the head of the Negro Masons in this state. He was very influential in the Negro community, had been a socialist, and come over to the party through reading the Daily Worker. And there's an art instructor here in town who used to peddle the route of the Daily Worker free in the Sixth Ward. And Hansbrough was one of them. He started reading it and throwing it away at first, you know. And then he started, I mean, first throw it away, then he started reading it, and then he became convinced. And he joined the party and became one of the national leaders of the party. The first, after Jim Ford, the first outstanding Negro leader of the party. And he came to the fore in this as one of our most eloquent speakers. You see, it was a very tempestuous thing. You can't even describe all the meetings that took place. You'd speak 20, 30, 40 times a week, you know, in all different parts of the city. Wherever the whim would take you, a flock of people come from the south side, say, my landlady's evicting me. You go down there with a gang of people and fight it out with the landlady. Or you would go over here by the library where the city's evicting somebody. Go over there and argue. You know how it was in those days. It was that way in Milwaukee, too. And you were running and running and running all the time and always busy. And what happened anyway, that they had, apparently they had really planned that they were going to scotch this thing about this time. So when our demonstration took place, we figured we had 25,000 people. In retrospect, I'd say maybe we had 5,000. But then we counted very optimistically. We had a big crowd. The Haymarket occupied a quarter of a square block, and it was full, jammed with people. There was a fence on the west end, and then there were canopies or porches around on the north and the east side, and there was a weighing station, and then there was a big open space down the other half of the block where the cars parked and so on. Well, we had our speaking, and our section organizer had been in Chicago, and he came in just in the middle of the thing, and he was able to speak. And We had decided beforehand, without revealing the line of march, we were going up to 6th Street, and we had to march past the socialist headquarters and boo them, you see. Then we had to march past the city hall and boo them. That was our politics. That's why I said in this talk of that conference that our mistakes went back much more than 10 years, because we were more interested in exposing the socialists and putting them on the spot than we were in getting joining with them against the capitalists, you see. And so we laid out a line of march that way. Of course, it went by our own headquarters. But we changed at the last moment. We went up, we started marching, and you should have seen that swarm of people pouring up there, you know. We just poured up the street there, Wheat Street, and we come up close to the top of the hill and decided not to go down 6th, we go down 7th. The cops kept asking, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go? And I was in the, up in the front, and I was sort of the general marshal of the parade in a way, and either I did it, or me, or the other guy, one or two other guys, it just happened to whoever be around. I'd say, let's go in. They say, you're right. So that's the way it was done, you know. It was really quite spontaneous. We went up to 7th Street, and there a milk truck drove into the whole crowd, women and children and men and everybody. Come pouring down the hill there and just drove, plowed right into everybody. And the people got out of the way. We swarmed in that thing, about four or five of us. Got in, and we couldn't get that driver out of the damn truck. We figured he was sent by the police, you see. We couldn't get him out of there. He just hung on, you know. Somebody pulled up the hood, they pulled off the wires, they pulled out the ignition key and threw it away. And that bastard, he was tough. And I got down on my back and I put both feet under his chin and kicked this son of a bitch right out of that truck. He went out that time. Meanwhile, the police were there. There was a whole squad of police there. And there was one guy, Sergeant Morrow, and you should see, he tried to interfere there. And the people were bouncing that guy on their hands up above the crowd just like a football. He was an over 230-pound man. He went to the hospital, and he was there about a month. You never saw anything like it. It's something elemental in the thing, you see. And so we swarmed down 7th Street, and that first clash with the truck and with the police sort of got everybody sparked up, you see. We had it organized, so we had marshals on both sides of the parade, and the crowds kept growing. People were on the sidewalk. You call them, they'd come in, you know, they'd come in. And it was just in the afternoon, factories were letting out, all the arteries pour into the center of town, you know. And the spirit of the people just kept getting rising and rising, began shouting and singing. We had about 100 people that would sing different songs. Hold the Fort, Solidarity Forever, and International, and those other old-fashioned songs. Go down singing, people looking at you. Streetcars would try to plow into the parade. The cops would try to direct traffic. It was hopeless. Well, by the time we got to the avenue, the whole thing was filled from curb to curb with a mass of people just flowing along, you know. And the streetcars, they just pulled the trolleys off. In some cases, they just pushed the goddamn streetcars right back on the intersection. Cars, we kept cautioning people not to use any violence, you know, but when cars try to drive in, they try to tip them over. They just pick them things up and rock them, you know, and rock the streetcars until the motorman was scared half to death, and you never saw anything like it. Then we marched down, we went down Water Street, down past the City Hall, and as we got up by the relief station on Market Street, we decided to, then we began to sense something, those of us who were in the leadership. By this time, the parade must have been a mile or more long, you know, and just from curb to curb. There's a tremendous mass of people. And all traffic tied up, we found out later that it took them 4 hours to unsnarl the traffic jam. The whole downtown was just a mass of people. It must have been hundreds of thousands of people. Couldn't go anywhere, couldn't do anything, so they were all watching the excitement, the communists. You know. And we knew something was coming because we were met with a solid phalanx of cops over on the east. And we cut across that bridge there, not the Cherry Street bridge, but the Pleasant Street bridge, back to the Haymarket, you see. And the cops were marching on both sides of us and in front of us, you know, just a solid mass of them, you see. We got in there and the people all poured in there, you know, and it was all filled up, you see. And we started speaking, we figured two or three speeches, and we will dismiss, you see. Well, I think Leo had spoken and Max had spoken and I was speaking, and then a long disturbance started over in the corner of the Haymarket. What had happened is an ex-Wobbly who had joined the Proletarian Party, and a guy who was leader of the Proletarian Party, Pete Zish, who's now dead. This ex-Wobbly by the name, I can't recall his name right this moment, it'll probably come around. This Zish had talked with Hohn about setting up a soup kitchen in the old armory across the river, and he wanted to make an announcement. We felt it was a provocation, you see. While the speaking was going on, he gets up and starts a counter speech, you see? So what happens? Somebody follows this ex-prize fighter, this Hungarian guy. Somebody just knocked him off the stool, you see? And the cops used that as a pretext. And they came in there. There was 1,200 policemen there. We found out there. 1,200 and four or six mounted horse policemen. They had machine guns by this time mounted up on these porches around there, you know. We didn't know that. And you could see the newspaper photographers running all over. You see, it's an open-air market with these porches, with the roofs, you see, sort of stores like the old. They run around there and take their pictures, and the goddamn cops up there, we found out they had machine guns. And the chief himself was in the weighing station. We didn't know that. But when this guy got, this Hungarian guy got poked in the nose and knocked off his stool, the police poured in from that corner there by Houston's soda farm, the soda business. They just poured in, about 600 of them, right into that crowd, you know. Then the horses started coming in. They started splitting us up in smaller and smaller groups. I was speaking on a table, and I stopped the speaking and run down to see what the disturbance was. And when this gang of cops come in, there was a great big old devil there, and he had a club. He shoved it into my belly, you know. Get back there, you know. And, you know, you act instinctively. You don't know what you're doing. I grabbed that thing, and one of these, this fellow from the British General Strike, he said, if a cop gets at you with a club, he says, grab it and twist it. You'll either break his wrist or you'll get the club away from him. And I twisted that damn thing, and it broke the strap. A great big old long club. I grabbed one, and he said, give me back my club, just like a kid that has candy taken away, about 6 feet tall. I run back to the club and jumped up on the stand, and I said, we asked for bread, and this is what we get. And then the hell began to fly. Them 600 cops come in. The horses started coming from that direction, and from that direction. The people got panicky. They made a big surge, you know. I was just off the table like that, you know. You didn't have nothing to do. I didn't know. By that time, we didn't know what was going on. You see, those cops were coming in, you know, that grim big line of blue, you see. But, and the whole crowd just surged over towards the weighing station a half a block away, you know. And as the first cops came in, then as the mounted cops come in from the other side, another line come in, they surged back, and those 600 cops just piled up like cordwood, about 6 feet high. And they were trampled and everything. You never saw anything like it in your life. And just that surge there, it took about, inside of 1 minute's time, 21 cops went to the hospital. And nobody hit him or anything. Well, of course, you don't know. In that crowd, there were guys that had grudges against policemen for 20 years. And they just took it out like that. Wham, 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 you know, it just went all over that place. And it was chaos there. No, all I know is what I saw.
They didn't shoot, though.
They didn't shoot. They had orders not to shoot. Oh. They had the guns, but they had orders not to shoot, just to use their clubs. And see, they learned from the May Day things in 86, you see, that the shooting, you know, it left very bad taste in people's mouths. And they were afraid. They were afraid it would provoke. They actually thought it was going to be leading to a revolution, you know. And if they started shooting, that the people would shoot back. A lot of Negro people there. And they were a little scared of them, too, you know. They had white chauvinist ideas that the Negroes all had knives and guns, you know, were going to lay for them. And they knew these wobblies. They knew the temper of the people in general. They were scared. And they felt that clubs would be enough. And all I know is what I saw myself, but there are a million little dramas like that that went on at the same moment. See, there you could study their strategy. It was very simple. Their whole strategy was to break the crowd up into small units. And to disperse it. And their tactics were to terrorize the crowd to make them run.
Those flying wedges. That
yeah,
they
all these wedges.
They went in like
yeah.
that. No.
Well, the first flying wedge just flew. I mean, you just wouldn't believe it unless you'd see it yourself. For a second there, you'd think somebody just was killing cops and stacking them up like cardboard. They were pretty near 6 feet high. Just the sheer weight of them, I guess, put some in the house. And the people running all over them, trampling on them. You never saw anything like that. But they split you, and then five or six cops get one person. They club the living Jesus out of that person. That frightens everybody else. It stuns them, you know, momentarily. Shocks them. So they done that. Well, I still had this damn club. I don't know what to do with that club. And as we were breaking up this unit, I was next to an old Irishman named old Mike Walsh. He was 71 years old, very, very tall, spare guy with all the signs of hard work and dissipation on his face and a big nose, you know. And here comes this motorcycle cop. And he says, "Now you sons of bitches are going to get it." And this motorcycle cop was built like a brick shit house, you know, to find an expression. He was real solid. I found out later he was the strongest man on the force. His name was Kugler. They said that they put a 200-pound man on a chair, and he grabbed the chair by the round like that and lifted the chair and man up with one hand off the floor. Well, he swung that blackjack back, and when he hit that old Walsh, I thought that blackjack was just going to do like that man said, cut him right down the middle. Walsh just crumbled, you know. Well, then he saw that he swung back to hit me, and he saw I had the club, you see. And he paused for a second, and I got him right over the middle of the forehead. And he just, you know, like that, and he staggered back about 15 feet and fell down. And then the other cops come. And there was von Stockhausen and this other Irish fellow.
You know that name?
Yeah, Sergeant von Stockhausen and Shuri and... I wish I could remember his name.
Every cop knows him.
Something like, and it wasn't Gavigan, it was something like that. But they're all dead now, thank God, every one of them, except von Stockhausen. And he's palm the beat up there on 27 cents. There's four or five of them. They come really flying. And those guys, and I had quite a tussle with von Stockhausen, but he was a Prussian, I think. He had some training in fencing or something. You couldn't hit that bastard. He just, like this, you know, and he'd fence with you. I took a couple swipes at them, and then they kept swiping back, and then I remember what this Englishman said, and I went down on my back, and you should have heard them clubs clicking. They were just swinging and hitting one another's clubs, and I pretended to be out, and I tried to trip them up, and I got hit on here on the arm, and then I got hit over the head, and boy, stars, I had a sore spot on my head that lasted for 20 years or more afterward, and boy, there's nothing more discouraging than that. Get a policeman's club over the head, that just takes all the starch out of it. So what did they do? They had these photographers taking pictures of us. They arrested some 87 of us. And when I got nailed, I could see others being hauled in, I got nailed. They had the squad car backed up where this trouble started by the police box there on 5th and Bleak. These devils, you know, they hit me by the arm and leg, you know. They were great big burly guys, you see. By the arm and leg, and come there and says, 1, 2, 3, and wham, just the full length of the paddy wagon up against the other end, you know. And there's one guy who was just bleeding from all, you just a sheet of blood from the top to the toe. Sonia Mason was in there. Some of the other, of our other people were in there too, you know. People were weeping and wailing and everything. They hauled us off to the jug, and they tripped. I had hit my glasses. I was afraid my glasses had broken because I didn't have enough money to buy another pair, and I hit them up in the headquarters in a jar of baking soda. The guys used to do their own cooking up there, you see. The district organizer and all the rest of them, the section organizer, I lived up there. And they had a artificial ceiling constructed in the YCL office, and that was their bunk. The three of them slept up there, and we cooked it on an old wooden garbage burner, you know, wood stove and coal garbage burner in the party office, you see. They had a sink in there and cold water, no hot water, and they warmed everything up. That's what they done the cooking. So I hid it in the baking powder. Well, they thought my glasses, they got broken, and I pretended to be stupid for a couple of days. See, I couldn't see, I was blind, everything. They said, I guess he got hit pretty bad. I figured I'd get the shellacking up there, you know, fairly well. Because there's nothing the cop takes the word another cop over the head, you see. So we were in the clink there, and we were in there with a bunch of murderers and bank robbers, and by God, they really took us to their bosom, you see. The Silverman brothers had just had a dramatic fight with the cops. They run all over the north side and shot it out with them after they held up a bank. They were in there, and I think they're still in Waupun. There was a southern guy by the name of Amos, I think his name was, that killed a grocer.
What
on
a memory he has.
And they, it's so vivid, you know. And of course we had the ever-present socialist jailers and guards and so on, you see. But these guys, what are you in here for? What are you in here for anyway? Oh, we were out making speeches on points on. Well, they said, this Silverman had one stock joke. They tell Ed Niemer and some of that stuff. You know what's wrong with you guys? You shouldn't have stood on a soapbox. You should have stood on your constitutional right. And we got along fine with that gang up there in the county courthouse. Then we had our trial. The trial took place in March, and then we all went to jail. A good mess of us. But
They went to jail all together?
No, we split it up. And our lawyer was Albert Goldman, who became a famous Trotskyite lawyer later on. See, the transcript must have been a million words or more. We could never get that transcript for an appeal. See, they said it had been destroyed. But all of a sudden it pops up in the case of this Leo Fisher in Chicago, when they're trying to take a citizen paper. They've got the whole transcript, but they wouldn't provide it to us back in 1930. We couldn't get it. So we went off to jail out there. Most of them got around, some got a 5 days, some got 10, some got 30. Four or five of them got 6 months. It was Fisher and Kagan and Perkovich. And Bill Felix, I guess, got 6 months. And some of them got a month or two. I got a year out of the thing. And so our...
How much did you serve the year?
Served the whole year except 15 days. Well, Holland, pardon me, got to be governor.
Where did you serve it?
In the county correction. They had as many as 1,400 and 1,500 prisoners at that time. They just, the House of Correction was sort of an adjunct to the Leaf Department. A guy by the name of Goodman, who was an American Legionnaire guy, and he's related to these Goodmans that have the funeral home here. He's Jewish. Had his face burned off in the war. So he started denouncing us that we're having classes, we're conducting communist propaganda in the jail. And all we had was state and revolution, land of imperialism, and we were just discussing, I think, value, price, and profit, or some other innocuous document. And so what happens is that they confiscated all our books and said no more classes in the dormitory, you see. Well, I corresponded with some of the people down at Madison, the professors at Nolan College, and I had asked Professor Malcolm Sharp and Professor Agard, you know Malcolm Sharp, they wrote this book on the Rosenberg. He was one of our professors at Experimental College. So I'd asked him for a copy of Shelley's poems and of Hegel's Logic, you see. I wanted to read them. It just happened they had red covers, so they confiscated them too. And we couldn't have any books. Well, the journal got wind of it. Sharp protested, I think. Some of the professors protested. Sharp said he had no use for my ideas, but, you know, he thought that he got too big a sentence. And so when he intervened, and his activity that I finally got a conditional pardon, got out 15 days ahead of time. The other guys had served their 6 months, and they got out on the anniversary of the Russian Revolution in 1930. They all went down the road throwing snowballs at one another. I never forget that, looking out of the jail window, watching them going down the road. And they confiscated all the books, so we knew we'd have to change our tactics, so we talked to some of the other prisoners, and when our comrades come with books, we had them give them to the other guys, you see. Then they got a new deputy warden in there, and he was a socialist. His name was Klein. That's the name of the Hungarian that I tried to remember before, Klein. No relation, and he wasn't a bad guy, the guy who busted up our demonstration. He wasn't really a bad guy, but it was part of the finagling, you see. This Klein was an old socialist. He became a deputy warden. The first deputy inspector, Benson, great big Scandinavian guy, the assistant to Mumsen. Mumsen was the chief inspector. Mumsen was a first or second cousin to the famous Mumsen, the Egyptologist, you know, from Denmark, the guy that wrote all the works on Egypt. This guy was first, second cousin. He was in charge of the workhouse out here. But he traveled around, he left it to his deputy. The first deputy was Benson. who was a great big old ignoramus, and his client came in.
I remember all these names.
No, Benson.
Yeah, 25 years ago.
No, Benson, anyway, he gave a statement to the papers, said, we can't have these books in this jail here. They're dangerous. Well, somebody said, well, what's wrong with books by Shelley? He said, Shelley says, I don't know the man. They can throw them around and hurt one another. And there's quite a circus. Anyway, we got him in through other prisoners. Inside of 2 weeks, we had all our books back and more besides, you see. But Fine says, what are the books they're howling about? And I showed him. I says, here it is. Karl Marx, Capital, Volume 1, 2, and 3. He looks at me. What the devil's wrong with these books? He says, I read them when I was a kid. He says, I've been reading them all my life, books like that. Pass them, he says to Benson. So we got him, and we read him. He's bigger than ever. With thousands of people, and this time, they insisted on having a permit. So we got a permit. Where are you going to march? Well, we got a fantastic notion. We want to march by the factories. We had some idea we'd march by the factories and call the workers out down tools on May Day. So we hold this damn march, and they were relieved to give us the permit. We marched down Clyburn Street and St. Paul Avenue down around the loft buildings in the Third Ward, thinking that we'd get the Phoenix hosiery workers, everybody out on strike, you see. And they, of course, that's what they wanted us to do. They wanted us off the main streets. But we were very happy. Yeah, we'd be around among the factories on May 1st.
Anybody come out?
No, not many. But didn't he ever tell you? Ask him about it.
No one ever tells me anything what they
did. They started hitchhiking. I'm not telling you exactly how it happened.
Well,
they
tell them exactly how it
They started hitchhiking. I can't remember it.
Oh, well, what they went up and they found these, they were meeting these guys. And they saw these guys and they looked right past him, you know, so he figured that they were being followed or something. So they were hightailing out. That's how it started.
Oh,
yeah. So they went across the bridge and got over in East Dubuque, and they couldn't get on buses and started hitchhiking. And guy picks them up and they get talking with him. Who is he? He's a deputy sheriff in Wisconsin, in that county down there, see? And they tell him the story about the troubles they're having. They can't get the buses and everything else. He says, hell, I'll fix that. He took them across the county. And he met somebody on the other side, another deputy sheriff, and they took him across that county where they could get a bus. Yeah, you have to get that. That as the daylight saving time comes on in Illinois, the time changes, you know, of the train. The schedules change. Mm. So I think I have plenty of time. As Mary goes back, I think you took me early. You had to go to work, didn't you?
Yeah.
And I had little time to kill, so I went in a tavern where they had some ale, and I had some ale, and I come down to the depot and find out my train has left.
Oh.
The schedule has changed. What the hell am I going to do? I'm due up in Minnehopolis, you know. I got to meet Martin and Clarence and Homer up there, and how am I going to do it? So I get talking with the guy. When's the next train? He says, there's another train coming through, but it don't stop here. He says, where do you work? In Rockford, anyway. I said, hell, I just work in a factory. I'm just plain working man. I work in a Grand Woodworking Company. He says, well, that's the outfit you represent. He calls up the vice president down in Chicago. He says, there's a fellow here representing the Grand Woodworking Company in Rockford. He has to make a trip to Minneapolis. He says, you do it quite often, don't you? Yeah, I says, I have to do it quite often. I'm supposed to have a meeting every 3 months up there at the National Farm Commission, you know. So I said, I do it fairly often. He says, yeah, he does it quite often. Can you have the streamliner stop here at Oregon? He says to me, as he hung up, he says, you see, if they stop walking enough, he says, they'll make it a regular stop. So they stopped that goddamn streamliner to let me on so I can make that, what's your name, Al Barlow, I said, representing the Grand Woodworking Company. Take a trip up there in Minneapolis. Get up there, and it's 35 below zero in Minneapolis. Down there, it was 29 above. We went up to Carl's house. Got down to 40 below, and the next day, in order to get back to Minneapolis, we had to spend about 3 or 4 hours with a blowtorch thawing out the,
battery?
Heating up the block on the engine so the car would start.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it was terrible, and it was so cold that none of us could stand. We couldn't even get the battery loose to bring it in the house because it was so cold out there. You'd take your gloves off for a minute or two, and your hands would be frozen, you see? We were running out trying, and we couldn't get it loose. And just like a typical farmer, he's got a whole machine shed full of junk and no wrench in the damn place that would fit the nuts on the battery.
This is Carl Flutquist?
Yeah. Not a wrench on the place that would fit it. And not a pair of pliers, it would get it loose. And everybody freezing, and we had to get fixed. Five cars in the yard, not one would start. I'll tell you, it was the most amusing thing you ever saw in your life. So we got it. And the leaders include these fellas who've been in the Socialist Party, the Progressive Party, and wanted to put Lafalle on the spot. But Dennis's idea and our idea in the board was that we had to call the thing off. What do you say, Mary?
Turn it up.
Oh, no, I thought she wanted to catch the story.
Yeah, I do.
So our idea in the board was that we should bring this thing to a head, to conclusion. And Dennis's idea was that we had to...
I worked with a... Oh, what are you doing?
No. All of a sudden, it's going to be
special.
He's a coy boy. He's a coy boy. Oh,
during the days when I was working with some other comrades elsewhere...
Away from which home were you?
Away from my home.
Which? I mean, the one with Grace?
Ben Board.
With your father and mother?
This was in the dark ages.
You mean in the recent past?
Before the Enlightenment.
This was before the Renaissance. Anyway, you know, the humor of the situation.
They were sitting in the Capitol, and it was reaching. They'd been there for about a week, and it was reaching the crucial point.
How did they organize?
I wasn't there. They had ways of feeding. They organized the food they brought in and everything. They went to the cans, I suppose. They slept down under the dome there. And they were lobbying, and they just were sitting down in the Capitol. And it was reaching the point where Lafalle would probably have to bring up the National Guard to get rid of them, see? Now, if you were if you wanted to kill Lafalle politically, that was the thing to do. But our considered opinion was we didn't want to do that. We wanted to make a united front with the progressives and the socialists, not to kill the father off and benefit the reactionaries, see? And it's a little known incident in the history of the state. These guys just wouldn't call that damn thing off, and they didn't want to come in. They were board members, too, of the party. Didn't want to come in and discuss it because they were afraid the decision would be against them, and they'd have to do what they didn't want to do. So my brother comes in, and here he is... He's a pilot, he's responsible to the board for the demonstration, and he can't steer it anymore. He can't do a damn thing about it, you see. Well, that was one of the weirdest board meetings I ever went to. It was up in Gene's house, and we kept waiting for the guys, and so Gene sent me out, and I got a quart of whiskey, and we put it in the middle of the table, and we kept discussing. The other guys didn't show up, and so Gene says, meeting come to order, you take that quart and put it on the table. Pretty soon, Peggy began threatening to go to the National Committee. get him thrown out and everything, and we finished the court, but nobody showed up, and we didn't know what the hell to do about that damn demonstration down there. You see? Well, we did succeed in getting to them somehow and getting them to get out of there before it reached the point of the militia being called in, you see? Now, that was really a weird business. How my brother and I got home that night, I don't know. We come home, I was carrying he had a red lantern from a ditch someplace, and I had about a 50-foot length of iron pipe that I brought home for our landlord because he was in the junk
business. How do they keep in touch with each other? Mainly through people sending messages, you know, through individuals or so on. So there may be five or six people. Each one would have a message to give to somebody else who might have seen someone, you know, a couple months ago and saved it up till they could pass it on. And so every time these people would get together, this is the way it would look. And this person and I discussed how the scenario would be written. We agreed that the soap opera should be written and it should be played and acted over TV as a serial, maybe to run for about 6 months, sometime about 10, 15, or 20 years later. The thing opens up with a bare stage with a center light, you know, the rest of the room dark, and the light shines on a table. And around the table is about a half a dozen chairs. First enters one comrade, comes in with a package, you know, just ordinary looking package. And he opens it up on the table and takes out a few documents, papers, puts them around the table. And then he looks at his watch and waits nervously for the others. And then finally he takes out from his pocket different notes. And he sorts them out. Enter next, the next one. And they greet each other, and this next one sits down, and he or she takes out, does the same thing from a purse or pocket.
Place
and they exchange
chair.
Notes, see? Then each one, as one comes in, they hand notes to each other. And then they sit down and read each other's notes.
I was just going to say, I could write one on these notes you receive. From how trees, and you get a note from some...
Oh, trees?
Yeah, we'd get a note from somebody we hadn't seen for 3 years telling you to do some impossible thing that you couldn't possibly do. And this would be handed down, as you say. It probably was about 6 months old by the time you got it, which made it a little more difficult to do it. And it was really bizarre most of the time, some of it. And you never did know who they came from, you know. I'd have pockets full of these notes that I was supposed to pick up in this hollow tree or that one.
The pumpkin.
Pumpkin.
Oh.
But you know who the king of the underground was?
You're as bad as Agnes.
Yeah, you know who the real king of the underground was?
Mm-hmm.
It was Alan Shaw.
Yeah, what?
He fell into really a pot of bliss down there in Chicago. Tell them all about that $3 an hour job and double time on Saturday and time and a half. He had a weird experience.
You know what? Let's go underground.
Yeah, for Christ's sake, we never made so much money in our life as we did when we was
never will again
position.
Either.
That's the
damn
truth.
How was that guy? He was a Croatian fascist, wasn't he? The guy that took a shine to you and broke you in on the job.
He helped get his wife.
With a Chetnik. And the guy's wife was a Nazi. Tell her that story about that. That's really one of the most amazing things I ever heard about the dinner that they invited you to. If you are
I'm not the mood.
Here you get this guy is either a Chetnik or a Ustashi, one or the other. He was a guy that was a Chetnik, yeah. And he marries a German woman who was a Nazi. Now, the way Al told it, the guy requested him to come over. He liked Al personally. He didn't know Al was a communist, a district organizer, anything like that. Otherwise, he might have more respect for him. But he just liked him. So what does he do? He invites Al over for dinner all the time. Well, Al kept trying to get away, but he had it to work, you know.
Was his boss?
No, he worked with him.
Yeah.
Well,
he worked with him.
So he goes over there to the house. And I wish Al would tell you, because it's an amazing story.
No,
German,
he remembers it better than I do.
I'm listening to it
like it's a new story.
Don't you remember furnishing the basement apartment and it got flooded and he had bought all the new furniture agony?
That's a different part of the story from
no, that. What I was impressed is picture this woman whose mind was just a blank, raised up under the Nazis, and she was just a cultural blank. That's
they were playing
and here
well.
We got sugar here and... And how much sugar cost in Germany, you know, and how scarce it was. Here we got this and we got that and everything. And Al got so bored finally, he knew the Philharmonic was on or some symphony orchestra was going to play the Ninth Symphony, and you wanted that, hear that, the worst way. And he turns it on.
That was the worst way.
And she hears that music. She said, nice music, yeah, nice music. She says, that's Beethoven. Beethoven, yeah, Beethoven. I heard of him, yeah. This is a woman raised under Nazis, you know, Beethoven, she heard of him. And then the vocal part comes on.
Wait, now just
song.
A minute. I don't follow you, or else I don't agree with you. What do you mean? She was raised under the Nazis, so she didn't have a love for music. That has nothing to do with it.
No,
she liked music,
not the point.
But she liked music, but she hadn't even heard of Beethoven, a German woman born and raised under the Nazis, you know. hadn't even heard of Beethoven. She just dimly heard of him. He knew he was a good musician. That's all.
But
and then when
there are many people, if they're not interested in music, so they wouldn't know who Beethoven was from a holy ground.
Grace, this was, it would be impossible for any German born that was raised before the Nazis in Germany. They knew
Fred,
Beethoven.
You got it wrong. They were playing Beethoven, and Alan started to sing. Alles
no,
Mensch.
No, no, no. You didn't let me finish the story. When this part come in, where they start singing, Alle Menschen, what is it? All men are brothers. And she heard the words. Al said that an expression of intense hate just came over her face. She couldn't tolerate it anymore. She is a German woman who had heard of Beethoven vaguely, because of the cultural abyss that had been developed under the Nazis. She knew he was a good German, and he was a musician, see? But she had no... But when she heard those words, that all men are brothers, she was... said it was just like the Nazis said. When I hear the word culture, I reach for my revolver. That's the way she expressed in her face. A real hatred, just of this sentiment. And it shows you what fascism does to people. It makes apes, it makes gorillas, it makes monsters out of people. And that's what this goddamn country is making out of people today with the TV and everything. Just ignorant apes, that's all, to a large degree. Of course, there are contradictory currents. We're not on a... I mean, we haven't had that fascist experience, but there is that tendency. That's what McCarthyism is.
Well, there's one thing
if
about...
If everyone in the country had been watching TV last Sunday night in Milwaukee,
not only that, but Les Miserables and Humphrey Bogart in Action on the North Atlantic is going to be on, but I don't know what channel. I think 19.
When is that?
I'm not sure, Grace. I just saw it.
We can't watch on the ride. Did you guys
they
see
put down the whole play?
Grace, what you don't understand, what a lot of us don't understand, really,
It was done on television, it wasn't the movie.
That may be true, but when you say that this woman didn't know or didn't appreciate fine music, you'll find that all over that.
You're
thinking of a different
thing. She liked the nice music. She liked the nice music of the third movement and everything. But when she heard those words, that all men are brothers, all men are brothers, that rung her Nazi bell.
The way you carry it out,
did she say anything?
Yeah, but you were telling, you were saying, the way you said is that because she was raised under a Nazi, she had no culture whatsoever, so that
she
didn't know.
She had a Nazi culture, which was no culture.
That damn cat is driving. I can't watch it. They make me so nervous.
Well, I'll tell you the difference. Where I worked in Chicago, for instance, there was some Mexican.
Get in the corner.
Look at that, look at that, look.
I'll tell you the difference. There were some Mexican workers where I was in Chicago, the last place that I worked before we left there, you see. And I got talking with them, and they could hardly speak English, and the guys were razzing them and everything. I got talking to them about Cervantes and Don Quixote, for example. You know that they all of them had read Don Quixote and knew him frontwards and backwards and sideways? And you take the average... A person in America doesn't even know Mark Twain.
You're lucky if you're reading in high school. No.
These guys are hardly literate, you know. But they knew Cervantes. They knew all the classical.